Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 30th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Daily Work and the Work of the World, presented by Lynn Rhodes, disc number RHL-2005-04.
And they were sending another petition, and he was talking to Congress about another issue. And she was walking down beside him. She said, you know, you have been in this for almost 90 years. I mean, since you were a child, you have been protesting and you have been acting. And she said, and I don't think you've ever won. And she said, what keeps you going? And she said, just straight as can be, just kept on walking. And he said, anger, just pure anger. And sometimes I think that's one of the wonderful gifts of God, you know, what is it that keeps us going? And sometimes it's just pure anger, sometimes it's just pure grief, and sometimes it's just pure joy. And there's always a combination of those, I think. I wouldn't be able to work if there wasn't joy in my life. I wouldn't be able to do things I do. But I probably wouldn't be motivated if I weren't angry. This should never happen again. No, that kind of resistance. So it's with that kind of understanding that I'd like to talk about Protestantism and the work of the world and identification of Protestantism in the U.S. and a little to reiterate some of the things I've talked about before, but to put it today in the context of the world. The history of sort of mainline Protestantism, which Lutherans and Methodists and UCC and Presbyterians are kind of classified as in the United States, is a history of identification with democracy and with capitalism. And it's been a very intertwined kind of history. And it's come to in a sense, that in general, our churches have identified democracy and freedom with what we have come to say as the best form of economic life, capitalism. Now, there is no such thing as pure capitalism any place in the world, and it doesn't exist here, but the idea of capitalism. So it is the economic model most compatible with democracy, and thus with Christianity. And as churches, we have protested its excesses, child labor laws, decent wages for workers. We have very little tradition of serious critique of that economic model. I've been in other places, like England, for instance. They have a very long and strong history of socialist Christians, of Christians who've really worked in other kinds of economic models. But in the U.S., those movements have been small and not really mainline in the main Protestant churches. And so, in fact, the many then believe that to attack capitalism is to attack Christianity. And it's been closely identified. And especially after World War II, in the grip of the world of the Cold War, when we were, quote, fighting godless communism, it was not only that we were identified with capitalism, but capitalism was going to save us from godless communism. And in that war, it also was unpatriotic and often unchristian to really question the assumptions. Then, with the fall of the Soviet Union, it was proven that capitalism is best. It was the other model, and when it, quote, failed, then capitalism became the dominant world power in terms of the ideological understanding of economic life. But however, in today's global context, where our economic systems are now global, and what we do in one world relates to every other, we do in our country relates to every other country, and vice versa. And as we're beginning to understand the ecological issues involved in our economic systems, this global power of what is supposedly a free market capitalism is really consists of global corporations that have few government restraints and immense power. They now exist extra statewide, and there's no governmental power that really is overseeing these kind of global corporations. We have international economic organizations, the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the World Trade Organization, the North American Free Trade Agreement. But mostly, they're institutionalizing the power of wealthier nations and corporations. Even though there have been attempts, they recognize some of the severe problems in the world, but they're answered out of that perspective, out of the understanding of what's best for the rest of the world, out of the wealthier nations' understanding of what other nations need. So there is a lack of social, political, legal controls and a lack of democratic processes. We don't have free trade. That's a euphemism for a very complex trades agreements that are not really free trade. We have, as you all know, this incredible debt for poor countries. The countries are paying more out in their debt payments. We just had this proposal to for the, I think it's the 19 worst, the countries with worst debt forgive the debt, which is very interesting. We think of the language, forgive the debt, as we forgive the debtor. and then the relationship also between economic control and military actions. All of, at least we know that part of what's happening in Iraq has to do with oil. It may not be the whole thing, but it is a serious part. I just got back from a trip to China, and one of the things China is doing is while the U.S. is using all of its money on the military, China is going around and buying up oil reserves all over the world. They're letting us use our money on military. It's very interesting. They're sort of sitting there letting us use our money on military buildup, which they're not doing, and they're just using that money instead to go and buy world oil resources. So it's very interesting what's happening economically. Just to back up and say, at one time I was a political science major in college, and I was going to minor in economics. So this has been an interest to me for a long time, and I've been reading a lot about it. And so that's the one thing is this is in when we talk about the work of the world is that it's changed from nation states and nation economic systems to a global economic system with no global oversight and no control over that. And if you look at the laws of corporations in the United States, the laws, legal laws, corporations are treated as people rather than as corporations. And so the restraints on them are very weird. They're not really in keeping with the problems.
Yeah. One example I usually give to my students is in the United States, 30 years ago, we decided we were not going to make DDT in this country. But what the companies do is they open up a company in another country that doesn't have those same ecological laws, and they make the DDT there. And then they can send it out to whoever they want. And I mean, that's, I think, one
that's
example.
Exactly, that's exactly. That's exactly an example. And then, so we're still getting the DDT
because of the wind
circle in there.
Right, ecosystems around the world are still being affected by DDT, but ours aren't. I mean, they are, you know, indirectly.
They will indirectly.
But not directly. But, you know, we're okay. So.
It's like cigarettes, too.
Right.
They're exporting cigarettes like crazy. So that whole issue of how what's happening is not how we understood growing up what happens, even if it had you know, it's, things are changing very rapidly in terms of, as you're saying, what happens in one part of the world. And you know different aspects of that that I don't know. And one of the things that I want to say, ultimately, is why we all need each other, because we have little pieces of this story from our own perspectives that we need to hear to help us understand the interconnections of this all. The other thing that is also clear is the immense suffering of human beings in our world. We know about that now due to the fact that we can communicate across the world. It's not as though we don't know what's happening in another country or what's going on. That this incredible lack of basic survival needs, the rising gap between rich and poor, not a narrowing, but a rising gap between that, the gap between rich countries and poor countries, and the rising expectations for unsustainable lifestyles. I think you've all heard the things that if everybody lived like we did, we'd have about 10 more years of Earth survival or some incredible thing like that. So what we're exporting to other countries are not only DDT and cigarettes, but expectations about a lifestyle that if everyone were to try to live with the and use the resources we use, it would be devastating on the Earth.
This is just one more thing.
Yeah, oh, go and break it anytime. I don't.
There's a really cool website that I have my students go to called www.myfootprint.org.
Oh, I
and
yes.
They do ecological footprints. And so what I have them do is they go and they answer, it's really short, 14 questions. They go answer kind of, you know, how many miles a week do you travel, what kind of gas mileage does your car get, what kind of housing are you in, what type of food do you eat, where do you buy it from, you know, online. And at the end of it, it gives them a calculation. How many hectares does it take in this world to support you in the manner to which you become accustomed to living? And then it says, if everyone in the world lived like you, how many Earths would it take to support you? Mm-hmm. And so I think this last semester, the lowest number of Earths anybody had was about 3.8. And so it's really, yeah, and the most, that word, yeah. And then the most, I think, was somewhere around 15. So it's really interesting, you know, for students who just, you know, for really anybody, but for students who don't see much beyond themselves to kind of think, wow, holy cow, so if I work this way, then, and if everybody lived like that, which is, of course, what we want. We think everybody should live the way we do. And then this last semester, the other thing I had to do was go pretend they were in a different country. So let's say you were in Mexico, and then you answer everything the same. Your footprint will be less simply because you live in a country that even if you eat a lot of packaged food, their packaging is different. So if you go to different places around the world, in Europe, when we were there last summer, they just don't have the packaging on all their stuff that we do.
Yes.
So the amount of waste that they produce per person is really so much less. So it's a really interesting comparison for them to do. It's real simple.
Yeah, I think that's
what
great.
Age do you use
at college? So possibly the most egocentric students, besides two-year-olds.
Do you think it would work with confirmation students?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think
yeah.
You might have to do a little bit more introduction because 13, 14, it might be a little beyond their ability to think big. But some of them really can. I mean, some of them get it. And it really changes how they do things through high school, so they get really involved in an eco club or something in high school.
Yeah.
But I think it's great for adults, too, because most of us think we know. If we're trying to live sustainably or low, and then you go answer these questions, then it tells you that it gives you an underestimate. When you go through and you read all the calculations and stuff, it says it's an underestimate. And so, you know, and then you look at it, you're like, wow, okay, now we're still 2.5. That's so good.
It's myfootprint.org, is that right?
Yeah.
Myfootprint.org, that's really, yeah. Well, that just leads into the third thing, which was ecological destruction. The not only the immense suffering that is going on in terms of people not getting enough to eat, but at the same time, the ecological destruction that is going on and finite resources. And then the fourth part of that, which I call, so it's the global economy, the immense suffering of people, the ecological destruction, and the fourth one is ideological captivity. And this is the one where I think we can do something really concrete about. Economic ideologies of human nature, what makes people work, why do they work? I think that there are assumptions, again, reading in economics, as technical as they get, they're always based on certain assumptions, you know, about human nature, how human nature works. And if you start off with certain assumptions, you get certain kinds of conclusions. And so to look at some of those, the concepts of wisdom, economic wisdom, TINA, have you ever heard the phrase TINA? T-I-N-A, it's called There Is No Alternative. It's been labeled by economists as, you know, that mindset that there is no alternative economic system. And the belief in that then makes it very difficult to deal with issues and provide other solutions because there is no alternative. And again, as I go around, I'm astonished by people who really care but who believe that deeply. The way in which this economy commodifies everything and everybody, everything has a price. Again, I go back to my experience in Cuba. When I was there, they were, you know, we were always questioning them about their political rights. You have the freedom to do this and that. And they kept saying, but what about your economic rights? They'd say, isn't it just as important that all children should be fed? Why is it you have a greater right to speak out than to make sure your child doesn't die from lack of food? And so it was this very interesting exchange between us about what is a basic right. And for them, there were basic economic rights. People had a right to free education, to free medical care. Every child had a right to food, no matter what their parents' status or lack of status. I thought, isn't this interesting? And those are rights. Now, why? You know, our rights are freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press. And not saying those aren't important rights, but
they're intangible.
That's very concrete, you know. Yeah. Every child has a right to food. As long as there is, you know, as there is any food available, doesn't matter what their parents are. It was also interesting in their laws, they had no illegitimate children. They said, there's no such thing as an illegitimate child. I love that in their laws. What a word, a child. How could a child be illegitimate? So even though I have great critiques, it put me up against my own worldview, you know, and began to see the limits of my own sense of self. There's a man called Philip Goodchild who wrote a book called Capitalism and Religion. And he's an English philosopher. He said that he wanted to write on these subjects, and it took him 5 years before he had enough courage to write what he was learning. It scared him. And he said the reason was is because he got, as a philosopher, he was looking at all these different things, and the one issue that just stopped him was when he began to uncover the immense suffering of the world. How did he, as a philosopher, really, with all of his theories and everything else, face that reality? He said, you can have postmodernist thought, you can have and you just come down to this fact, the immense suffering of the world. And he said that it was the contemporary truth of suffering that led him to this understanding that we are interconnected, everything and everybody. And he said, even if there were no soul true religion, no soul normal subjectivity, you know, who you are, how you understand things and how I understand things are different. It's all relative. or a sole normative culture, a sole universal history, or a sole universal economy, there remains a sole global ecology. So there is one thing that we all share in common, and that is the world, and what is happening to it, and our interconnectedness to how that shapes us. And so his thing was that we were going to have to start talking about God again as philosophers. Isn't that interesting? His conclusion was we're going to have to claim certain values as philosophers. We're not going to say it's just subjective truth or things, but that there are some things that we're going to have to claim, not as universal truth so much, but as universal realities that need universal attention. And so this is why I see the church as this theo-economic visioning community, why I think it's so important for us to begin as a collective church to imagine what is possible economically. He said, you may protest that this is not your world, this world of immense suffering and what he sees as destruction, total destruction. He said, this is not our experience, this is not how we think. He said, good, let us cry out against economic reductionism. Let us then validate what it is we see as really providing the resources of the world.
By that
capitalism, there is no alternative. That the bottom line is the bottom line. That the economic ideologies of the world are not providing what we need, and therefore we cannot let them determine. Economism is another word. You know that in the United States we talk about. Yesterday I was talking about businesses, the bottom line being productivity. That's a belief that if you don't increase production, you can't survive. Maybe we should question that belief. Maybe increased production is not necessary. Maybe different kind of production. Do we need 42 different kinds of shoes? Instead, what if the goal were every child has a pair of shoes? And that was an economic goal. That's a very different one than higher production, which higher production then demands increased consumption in a world where that's not working. But it's a belief in a system that is what keeps you going and what keeps us healthy. And what we're saying is that we as Christians have got to begin to raise doubts about that as being what is true. Remember yesterday we talked, to make true what is true. And I think that is economically, we are not to be, Sally McFaig, have you read her? She has a book called Life Abundant, Rethinking Theology and Economy for a Planet in Peril. And I think it's a basic book. For those, if, I don't know, have any of you read that? Sally McFaig, let me just put that up to you. Do you know her? She is a theologian. Sally McFaig. And her book is Life Abundant. And I think she writes for all of us to understand. She's not writing for theologians, she's writing for us. So I think it's a good study book for a congregation. Yes.
I missed out on the other day, so maybe you are aware of this or mentioned this, but have you seen the book A Prayer for the Prairie? I believe is the title, Discovering Faith. Close to the title, I can't tell you the exact author, but basically this family on a North Dakota farm begins to rethink how are we going to live and how much do we need to live sustainably, and does a very nice job of bringing faith into that question of how much do we need, and then how much, you know, is more better, is the basic question that they're wrestling with, both in terms of themselves and in sharing with others.
Anything like that, I think we can gather those resources. One of the things that I discovered when I'm doing this research is just what you said. There are immense resources out there. People are doing all kinds of creative things. And on one level, it sounds like nothing is going on, or it seems like that. And then when you begin to explore, you find vast communities of people who are developing alternative ways of living, that are developing economic systems, that are developing ways to work internationally, all kinds of levels, and it's truly exciting. It's truly exciting. I mean, just even in terms of helping kids understand what's happening in the ecologically.
I was also thinking about in terms of what government has done or has not done. There's a really nice series in the Sacramento Bee earlier this year about California, because California has all these great environmental laws, and so as a state, we try very hard to protect our environment. But what that means is we farm out our stuff, and so we're causing Canadian fisheries to crash, and we're depleting lumber down in Central America because, you know, we have laws, so we maintain our stuff, but we want other people. We still want our stuff.
We still want our stuff.
Yeah.
just one more footnote on that. I happen to have a resource when I was doing stuff for Senator. It's called www.globalrichlist.com. And you can plug in your salary for a year and figure out how much richer you are than, you know, like at $50,000, you're making more money than 96% of the people in the world. Yeah.
Which should make you feel pretty good.
What's that?
It should make you feel pretty good.
And, you know,
because 50,000 in this country.
It's just, you know, just an average wage in our culture, you know. You're actually, you know, at that point, 96% or below of economic well-being.
I've been trying to live on this.
I'm trying to learn more, yes.
Yeah.
There is an organization called the Northwest Earth Institute that produces materials that you could use for small groups. And the three of us in our church, we're in a group on globalization that involved in a lot of the implications of globalization. It was an 8-week study, so we had a chapter a week that we read. And it made all of us angry.
As I said, what we do with our anger is always the question, but but it's a motivating force.
Yes.
Personally, as I was growing up, when I went to seminary, I was there were two of us, two women in the MDiv program, and when I was going to, I decided I didn't want to stay at that seminary, which happened to be PSR, and I said I was going to go to another seminary. They told me that I wouldn't get into the other seminary because women who changed seminaries only did it because they couldn't find their husband in the first one. That was from the administration of the school. And also that I, quote, on the psychological test was more masculine than was normal for a female. And it took me years to find out that meant any woman who got into graduate school tested that way. At that time, the way they, you know, the way they fixed the thing, anyone who wanted to do that was, quote, more masculine than normal. And all the men in seminary were, quote, more female than was normal. So it, because they had some little carrying factors in their makeup. But it was anger that, you know, I just thought, what fools, instead of being devastated, which a lot of my friends were. So I've always been thankful for anger. It kept me going at times when I could have been just depressed.
I will also say, though, that it confronted us with what each of us could do to make changes, you know, to our lives.
there are so many things we can do, and it's partly people get overwhelmed by, well, what difference does it make if I do this as versus what, you know, the international forces. And I think that's why it's so important as a community to work on these things together, is to think, you know, there are very different levels of things we can do. Our own personal lifestyle, our advocacy for policies, our advocacy for confronting the ideologies that are denying people the creativity to think about alternatives, training our kids to become economists, working at the local schools to make see that the kids get other ways of looking at the world, because we are countering incredibly deep cultural expectations about what is a meaningful life. And that's one of the things I love about places like Holden, where kids can relate to each other around some values that we think are important, so that they have peer support for these kinds of things. How important that is, I think, for them in this culture.
The media doesn't really let us know what's going on. That's the problem. So that's awareness, I think.
Right, right. We have to be the advocates, the public voice. One of the things that we've talked about in our school is, what does it mean for those of us with this understanding of Christianity and faith to have a public voice? Because public, you know, without being a voice that says conversion, you've got to believe my way, or you know, I'm going to vote you out of. But how do we have a public voice that begins to provide an alternative worldview that says there are other ways to think about what it means to be a human being? There are other ways to organize our economic life. And we are not, and we're speaking out of our own truth. You know, it's not God, I love this book by Martha Ellen Storz. Do you know her? She's a good Lutheran from PLTS and a good friend. She's written a book, A World According to God. I don't know if any of you have seen this or not, but she says, imagining a world according to God is one of her chapters. I think, isn't that interesting? We say God is the God of creation, and yet we're going to have to do a lot of imagining to imagine what the world is according to God. There's so many ideologies that are clinging to us, and so as a community, to try to think about that. And then the real tough task is, what does it mean in our daily work life? Not what we just do. How do I understand what it means for what I do daily? And it doesn't, how do I put that together with getting enough money to feed my kids, to send them to schools, to do all of these things that we talked about? How do I understand that with that global perspective and my daily work life? Because what I want to keep coming back to is that we are expending our energy every day, most of our energy in our work lives. And some of us have the privilege of seeing, being very obvious to us that what I do leads to something I care about. And we're the privileged few. Most of us don't have that choice. So how do we help each other understand what it means when we don't have a lot of choice about our work? What does it mean to expend our energies in those places? Are there options? Are there ways to push organizations to different ways? What does it mean to be a worker? What does it mean to be the business operator? What does it mean? And how do we not just guilt trip each other or condemn each other, but believe in each other's desires to try and create work that really does not destroy the world at a minimum and hopefully helps recreate it? And that's where I think the real tension, see a lot of us making a lot of social announcements about things, but how do we deal with our life energy every day? How is that related to the work that we do, where we expend all this energy, and the things we care most about? How do we put those together? And I think it's complex, it's ambiguous, it's not easy. But what I would hope is that a church community would be the place where we could talk about it without fearing. And, you know, I have so many business people say to me, well, I don't want to talk about my work in church because they just say I'm an evil person. And I say, well, you know, I'm having real troubles with what you're doing. But how do we have conversations with each other to understand and then to begin to push what we have very limited imaginations. One of the things our culture does is limit what is possible. And what is astounding to me is when people really begin to think that they can live their faith, they can be more faithful, what boundaries we can push, how much more room there is than we think there is for creativity and for creating pockets of newness. But I don't really know how we're doing this yet in places, because there's, you know, as a teacher, I'm in a very privileged situation. But as I told you before, I'm living off of income of the people who are doing the work that I'm talking about. It doesn't exactly make me more virtuous. It doesn't mean I shouldn't keep talking about it, but it does mean I need to do it with some humility and with some desire to really try and work with others who are coming from very different places on that. So that is one of the things that for me is this issue is how do we then, what I think for churches, when I'm thinking about churches, is that we need to do basic education about economic ideologies. That all of us have to take on. Sally McFaig, again in this book, said she was a theologian and she didn't think that she could, and she was doing a lot of work on ecology, and all the books she wrote as theology books. And she said, now I realize that I had to write something on economy. I could not act as if economic theory was outside my realm and I couldn't deal with it. When economic ideology is determining life, all of us have a basic stake in questioning whether that economic ideology is serving life and if there are better ways to do things. And that's sort of our bottom line. We have to begin to think about that. What that's going to be is varied and diverse, and there's going to be no one answer. There's going to be a lot of experimentation, but I think that's sort of the thing that I think that it is, there's no avoiding it. And what she says is what we need to know as people is not technical things, but the assumptions and results of our consumer-oriented economic theories. Yes.
What do you think about what is going to happen or what the directions might be of in our society, in American society, we are going to move from a worker economy unless we somehow lower the barriers to immigration in a way that probably isn't very likely in the present. We're going to become, the whole idea of productivity, increasing productivity is going to really become a hollow dream.
Yeah.
And do you have some thoughts about that, about when we have more and more people who are going to not be workers, depending on fewer people over, what do you think that, what are the opportunities, what are the fears?
Yeah. Well, there are two responses. One is this thing about having to understand work as wage, because on the one hand, there is immense good work that needs to be done. All of us could be just busy as little bees the rest of our lives doing good work. I mean, restoring land, taking care of children, caring for people who need assistance, education, planting, restoring, caring. the work that needs to be done in the world is immense, and there's lots of it, lots of good work for us to do. So on the one hand, when I say, if we equate work with wage, as wage earners, in a system that only gives wages for certain kinds of work, then we have some real serious problems, because non-workers then are not productive and are a drag on the community, etc. But if we thought about what does the work that the community needs, and then began to think about ways, okay, how do we support people doing the work that needs to be done? If we started from that premise, we might begin to think about ways to organize our lives that provides ways for people both to do the work that needs to be done and to survive. Those are the questions. How do we, and some of that is, you know, the old barter systems, you know, living simply, needing less, living closer to our local produce and local products when we can, not the transportation issues, and then really the interesting things. Jeremy Rifkin wrote this book, No More, you know, After Work or something, about 10 years ago, about this whole issue about what we're going to do when basic labor was not needed, when it's all going to be mechanized or sent overseas for cheaper labor. And he said about, I think it was a third, I couldn't believe it, a third of the work in the U.S. is done by nonprofits already. Nonprofit systems, where you're not, it's not productivity and things, but it is you know, keeping things going in a non-profit.
Was he including government?
Well, probably was included, because I was thinking, what could he mean by that?
But I work for a non-profit hospital where productivity is everything. And the CEO pulls down a $1.5 million salary a year.
Right. That's not what we call non-profit here. But yeah. I know.
But, you know, a lot of things can fall under the umbrella of non-profit.
Well outside of what you would call private. Yes. Well, it's not that we don't need to. I mean, like healthcare, for instance. Let's just talk about providing basic healthcare for us. And there's, you know, so it's. But the idea of profit making as the only way to develop systems. It's going to take, there are cooperatives in the U.S., there are small-scale things that are happening all over in terms of ways that people are trying to reorganize work life so that it's, that in, and sharing. You know, one of the things that, in a personal level, is at a certain point in my life, I lived communally, or with a group of people. And I had to make so much less money to survive. Now I live on my own in Berkeley. And my life was as rich and full then, more so than it is now. And what we did was, we had a common fund for, my salary was $2,000 a year. But what I had was, we put money into retirement, money into health care, and money into emergency fund. And then we lived with groups of people in which I got out of it as a single person with no children is I now have four godchildren that are as dear to me as could possibly be, that I know from the moment they were born. And so it's different ways of organizing our family lives, different ways of talking about how my worries and fears are not so much about my daily stuff as about my retirement, about my health care, about emergencies. That's where if we have some more common ways of putting those things together, we don't all need to have the same thing. I don't know if this is legal anymore, but when I was in the campus ministry, we had a health a health plan, and we had about 100 people on a health plan. We paid them $1 a year salary, and they could all join our common health plan. That was much cheaper than individual health care. And they were all doing different kinds of social work that wasn't paying for health care. And so they all belonged to our common health care plan. I don't know if that, probably the health care plan, people are a little more rigid about that. But they paid in so much and got cheaper health care. So there are, I mean, that's what I think about. Stretching the imaginations of ways of creating different lifestyles is one level to start, yeah.
I serve a, I guess you'd call it an upper level, blue collar kind of a congregation. And the people that are of the age of being productive workers, for the most part, are people that do not attend church regularly. I think particularly of one woman whose idea of being good to her children is how many things that she can purchase for them. And the question that I have as a pastor is, how can I, to a woman that isn't even hardly ever in church, but has children, bring a message of grace to this woman in such a way that she can envision her world differently, that there's something else out there other than just giving things to buy her children's love. Mm-hmm. You're talking about envisioning, and there's one thing about bringing that message to people who are, retired, committed, it's a totally different thing to bring that message to the people on the margins of my community.
One of the things that some of us have done is pastors have spent much more time in the work field. I mean, in the work, visited people at their work sites instead of in their homes. I've seen that as getting to know every person's work site. And that brings up what's going on in work, why do you work, how hard do you work, what does it mean about I spend all of my time at work, I never get to meet my children. That what I have discovered over time is I may have this big social analysis, but if I'm just willing to start talking with somebody, they bring up all the issues. I never even have to bring them up. They may be in very different ways and from different perspectives, but what people have told me is that Pat, from their perspective, not who's sitting in this room, but in general, pastors do not engage people with their work lives. They tell them about who they should be and what, but they don't ask them, what's going on at your work? How is it? What's happening? I'd love to come have lunch for you with you and see where you are and what's going on there. What do you think about it? What do you enjoy about it? What's going, you know, what are the issues? I want to understand how you understand your life. And this, again, this association of ministry in daily life was started by this guy called Bill Deal. He's written books on ministry in daily life. And he was an executive with Bethlehem Steel. And he was so upset because the church would never engage him in the issues of his real work life. And so he just started his own organization and his own books and his own little meeting. He would call other people together and they'd have little breakfast meetings and they'd have prayer and they'd talk about their work life and the real ethical issues they were facing and the real kind of concerns they had. And so from his perspective, it was that the pastors were never interested in the work lives of the people. They either wanted people to volunteer for church work. And that's what work was how can I get you to do something in the church? But not that I'm going to spend my time. I was in one of these groups once with a group of laity and pastors who were all concerned about this issue, about work and daily life. And we all were in this conference for 4 days. So we had all of these panels and everything. And finally, in the last was we got together in little groups and we made, we were supposed to do a little play around some issue, make up a little play. So I was the only seminary type in my little group, and the rest of them were laity. And so they said, okay, what the kind of church we want is that we want you as our leader. We don't want you to preach so much anymore. We want you to help us talk with each other. We want you to visit us at our work. And we want you to go around to the organizations. You have the time that we don't, to go visit what's happening in our town so that we know where we would make the best, where we might really, as a community, make some changes in what's going on. When we reported back to the full community about this, their proposal for church, the pastors all said, oh, I couldn't do that. I can't give up my preaching. You just want me to be a highly paid secretary. It was, so the vision of what would really be a church support for their daily lives changed the pastor's role quite dramatically. And it doesn't mean that there are so many things, of course, they didn't know. I mean, the pastoral care issues that are so overwhelming are still there. But then another group began to talk about, as pastor, teach us to care for each other in ways that when you're not around, we can take that on. But also that we talked about before, we're in this cycle where each of us pushes each other to our own extreme. You're the pastor, I'm paying you, do your work. So I get it as a pastor, you know, expectations. On the other hand, I as pastor set up certain ways of being that make people more passive. And it goes back and forth between that passivity and how do we break that when there is, it's not that either of us aren't working, but we haven't broken through how to really talk about our work lives. And I talked a little bit about that before, some of the reasons I think that is in terms of our understandings of vocation. But that's what they said. Just talk with us. Start with just asking me what, you know, what's going on in my work life, what I feel about. And then from there, her concerns about her kids and why she buys gifts might begin to emerge, because she doesn't have time with them, and she's guilty about that. Or because they come demanding that, and so you could say, how could we create an environment for our kids that they wouldn't think that your love was based on whether you gave them this best gift. So it's that level. Any other things immediately, because we're at that time again. And I'd just like to stop with this one thing from Henri Nouwen. He says, my deepest vocation in the midst of all this world economy and everything, is to be a witness to the glimpses of God I have been allowed to catch. And what I think of as a church is that what we do is together we tell each other about those glimpses we've caught so that we begin to see the wholeness of God as actually working there in the world, and that God really does reveal to us ways of working that give life. And that's our belief, and I hope we can live it. But I think it's hard. Okay, well, I'll see maybe some of you tomorrow, but have a gorgeous day.
Who was your last quote by?
Henri Nouwen again. Henri Nouwen. It's a little card that was in the bookstore.
I love that.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
I just thought, oh, my deepest vocation, I was completely, you know,
by just those first few words.
Is to be a witness, and I think about that as Christian witnesses. You know, we witness to that love, and out of that witness, our actions develop.
But I also like the idea that you're witnessing to glimpses, not the whole picture, but just to glimpses, and that's all I can claim.
That's right. I've seen
a glimpse.
Yeah. And that keeps us from this.
Yes.
This horrible way of telling other people,
right,
you know, what it's all about.
Right. Lovely.
Good.
Thank you.
Well, you can go by the car.
I will. I'm going to.
I was just so taken with it. Oh.